Welcome all to another edition of A Positive Podcast, where we work to enhance our lives by exposing the tools that we already have inside of us. My podcasts are designed to be short inspirations that will take these proven methodologies of positive psychology and give you examples and deeper insights on how to practically apply them in your own life. In some other of my podcasts, I've shared some tips and tools. Today, as I will do on occasion, I interview someone who can share wisdom and life experiences that essentially do the same thing, teach you that you have, or we have, the answers inside ourselves. Today, we have the privilege of interviewing an amazing man, a musician, and a kind, creative person, Avremi Garari, or as many people know him, Avremi G. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I know this is a very sensitive time, a very sensitive topic, and the wounds are still very, very raw. So if I cross any lines, please don't hesitate to tell me and let me know, because I think it's very important. So let me start off by asking you, tell me a little bit about yourself. I know you're a musician in Crown Heights, but give us a few minute background about where you are from and catch us up to today.
Okay, first of all, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be on your program. I was born in Cape Town, South Africa, where I lived till I was 4 years old. Grew up in Johannesburg, South Africa. At the age of about 17, like many Lubavitcher young men, I came to the United States to go to yeshiva. I was in Morristown. Went through the whole yeshiva experience, ended up marrying an American girl for my green card. That's a joke.
Okay.
And I'm here ever since. I'm an accidental musician, meaning that I never intended to become a musician, but a long story short, I met Yasin Avipimenta, and we connected, and that's how it started. I married my wife, Dini, maiden name Lipsker. We have three wonderful children, and living in Crown Heights ever since.
Wow. Okay. So, tragically, you lost your daughter recently.
That's correct.
And this is, of course, why we are talking today. And first of all, I want to commend you for agreeing to talk with me. Your writings on Facebook that you take, your very public stance that you've taken on mental health issues and specifically with eating disorders. If even one life is helped or saved, and I'm sure that many are being helped by your openness, it's going to be worth your public writings and talking on this important issue, because one life is a whole world. And being that this is so sensitive, please take a few minutes to share as much as you're comfortable about your daughter's journey, while obviously respecting whatever you need to keep private.
Okay, so before we do that, let's talk about privacy. And you didn't use the word stigma, but I'm going to introduce it to what I'm going to say. And there is a misconception about that. People think that if you don't talk about it, it's because there's a stigma about it. But as parents, we don't talk about it sometimes because we want to respect the privacy of our children.
Yeah.
And we did that, even though I'm quite an open person. That stopped when she decided to go public with her own story. So I think the question was about her journey. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So when she was very young, I would say 7th or 8th grade, it became noticeable that she had an eating disorder. An eating disorder, in her case, restricting or becoming anorexic. In later years, there were binging and purging and so on. As I know now, eating disorder is the most misunderstood mental disease. I'm here 10 years later, or 11 years later, I still don't understand it completely. We started getting her treatment at the end of elementary school. And in truth, we didn't know much. So we just were going by what the doctors were telling us. They were helping us, they were not helping us, and so on. Then she went to high school. And just so you understand, those that have an eating disorder, in many cases, I don't know if it's in all the cases, just want to just disclaimer, I'm not a professional, so I'm just going to tell you from my own experience. But I can tell you from my own experience that in our case, and I know it's true in many cases, that the one suffering from the eating disorder keeps it very, very private and secret. And in order to be successful in their own eating disorder, they try to keep it from those around them, their loved ones, and try to make it all appearances that they're doing well. And I guess that's what happened. You know, we thought that she was doing better than she really was doing. She went to high school not in Crown Heights. She attended a high school in the Five Towns called Madrasa Shalavat. And she was super academically motivated and successful, quiet. She was always respectful. She never had she was never angry, didn't have a rebellious bone in her body. It was in her senior year in high school where actually a fellow student of hers noticed that something is amiss and she better speak to the school psychologist. And one thing led to another, and she was taken again to see someone who had specialized in eating disorder doctor. And this is when the story became more serious. My wife took her to the doctor, and she was at the appointment, and then my wife calls me up and says, "Remy, we're not coming home, we're going to the hospital." I said, why are you going to the hospital? And she said, "Yechevet's cutting, self-harming." And I said, "What's that? What is self-harming?" Yechevet was cutting herself on parts of her body that she was able to keep hidden. It took me years to understand what it is, and I still don't fully understand what it is. And because of that, the situation was very apparent that it was quite serious. She went to hospital in Westchester, eating disorder clinic, which remained for about 2 or 3 weeks. From there, she did a step-down program in a place called Renfrew, Manhattan, which is a day program, also an eating disorder day program. We thought she had made strides, and she did make strides. I mean, she had written about that. She she did make strides, especially after that. She took a gap year after high school, and then she went to college. And she writes about the fact that it became quieter. Her disease became quieter during college years, and she did very well in college. Graduated with a degree in psychology and a minor in neuroscience with a 4.0 GPA. Took another gap year. Actually, it ended up being 2 gap years, where she traveled a little bit. She spent some time on a farm. She started applying to nursing schools. She went to become a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I think during this time, after college, things got a little worse. And if I can make a connection between inactivity and filling your brain with things that are probably not good, or especially those people that are predisposed to mental illness, if they're not kept active, it can get worse.
Yeah.
But in her defense, both after high school and after college, I, for one, encouraged her to take some time off because she worked very hard in school and she worked very hard in college. And I didn't want her to just be overworked. And I thought that was also very unhealthy at the same time. Do you want to just fast forward to November of 2019? Go ahead.
Whatever you feel comfortable with that you feel will be helpful and go ahead, share.
So I'm not certain if I'm filling in all the details, but I guess this is the main topic. So I'm just going to skip to November of 2019. Now, again, at this point, she was really seeing a psychiatrist for about a year. And I learned much later, the efficacy of drugs, what that means. But she was seeing a psychiatrist to kind of help her open up. We were looking for a therapist. We didn't find, maybe it was half-hearted on our part, and the fear of cost and so on. But it wasn't a concerted effort, put it that way. Not that we would have denied her therapy at all. She had a therapist in at Brooklyn College. There were services she could have turned to over there. And then in November 2019, she had her first suicide attempt. And then things changed rapidly from there. She was hospitalized, first in Cornell, to physically stabilize her in Manhattan. And then she was transferred to a hospital in Westchester, which is a psychiatric institution. This time she was not... in the eating disorder unit as she was when she was in high school. She was put in the psychiatric unit. It's actually a Frum unit, Orthodox unit. She wasn't thrilled about that. That's the truth of the matter. They put her there because, you know, they thought we're Orthodox, so put her in that unit. But, you know, throughout high school and college, she had a variety of friends, most of whom were not Orthodox and probably most of whom were not even Jewish. Mm-hmm. Very, very close friends. So she was okay with that. She was more of a modern girl, I would say. Let me back up to tell you a story that happened right before this first suicide attempt, because I think this would be instructive to those that are listening. That is, we're from a Chabad family. Chabad women do not, and I wrote about this on Facebook, so you're probably familiar with it, but I'll just say the story. Chabad women, as many Orthodox women, do not wear pants. There are laws of modesty and so on. Women do not wear pants. Right before this first suicide attempt, she and I had attended, we went out one night to the October 30th, because that's when they have it, the Halloween parade in New York City, Greenwich Village, which I've always loved. And we went together. We had a great time. And I noticed that she was wearing jean pants underneath a skirt. We were close, and she never wanted to affirm me. Again, like I said earlier, not a rebellious bone in her body. And I noticed that she was wearing jeans underneath a skirt, and I said to myself, this is crazy. At this point, she's already 22, 23 years old. She's an adult. She's struggling anyway. And we knew that she was struggling with eating disorder and body image and so on and forth. I thought to myself, you know, if she wants to wear pants, she should be allowed to wear pants. And I discussed it with my wife, and my wife said, you know, we should discuss it with others, rabbonim, and people we trust. And the consensus was, yes, that why not? You know, let's not add to her struggle and her pain. So we're gonna talk to her about this, but in the interim, she had a suicide attempt. So my wife and I would visit her every day in hospital, every single day. This is pre-COVID. And one day during that hospitalization, I came to her and I said, you know, Yechaveh, I think, remember that evening we had, I noticed you wearing pants underneath the skirt. I said, you should wear pants. I encouraged her to start dressing in that way, because I knew it would, she would be more comfortable. And it was like this burden was lifted off her shoulder. And indeed, when she was discharged from hospital, she bought a whole new wardrobe. And I told her, you know, I'll walk in the neighborhood with you, and I'll defend you, and if anybody, you know, criticizes, none of that happened. There was tremendous support from family and friends. And I think it helped her. You know, I think it helped her for that year, when she completely changed the wardrobe. She was, when she went to family events or community events, she was very respectful. This is not a, like I said, not a person who was rebellious. She was struggling, and that's the way she had to dress. Yeah. Fast forward to the whole idea of not putting religion ahead of care, and that's one of the messages I want to get out there for those that are struggling and those that have religious families that never put religion ahead of care. And I think you'll speak to any rabbi, and they'll tell you that, especially when you're talking about a life and death situation, not a minor situation, but a major situation.
Yeah.
Right. So that was her her first suicide attempt. After should I just continue with the story? Is that okay? You have any
please,
questions?
Please.
Yeah, okay. After she was released from hospital, she was the way it works in with these kinds of hospitals, especially after a suicide attempt, they want to know what's going to happen next. So they released her to what's called I think it's called IOP or PHP, partial hospitalization.
Yeah.
IOP stands for, I forget, I think it was IOP. I forget what it stands
individual,
for.
Individual, I think, I forget too. It's a step down. It's only down a few hours program. A day. Right.
It actually wasn't 2 hours a day. It was a full day program.
Oh, really? Okay, so it's probably PHP then, but okay.
Yeah. This was in Manzana, Manhattan. She was there for a few weeks where she actually did very well. And one of the things she did very well with was something called DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, I think it's
yes.
called.
Mm-hmm.
She did very well with this, and she was, you know, really doing well, and she was going to be let go from this program. We had a couple of family meetings with the social worker, And the discussion was, okay, what's next? And what was next was we knew very, you know, clearly, since this was a suicide attempt, that we're going to have to pull out all the stops in terms of therapy, in terms of psychiatry, nutritional therapy, and so on. So the discussion was between the four of us, myself, my wife, Yocheved, and the social worker, what's next? So Yocheved was very open to therapy, and we were going to, like I said, you know, whatever the cost was, we were going to get the best therapist, which we did. And but at the same time, we wanted to have nutritional therapy. Now, for those that don't know, you know, everyone knows what a nutritionist is, but there are actually those that practice as nutritionists that specialize in the area of eating disorders. That's their specialty. So, you know, I could have gone to the local nutritionist and doctor's office. Our doctor himself told us, you know, we need to go to someone who specializes in eating disorders. There are actually two companies in New York that have a whole team of nutritionists that's all they deal with is you know, nutritional health when it comes to eating disorders. So there was an argument. I wanted her I kind of felt that if her brain was not nourished, if she was malnourished, then she would not be able to attack the depression components of her sickness. And the psychiatry, we even found out at the time, or even later, that when it takes medicine, if your brain is not nourished properly, then it diminishes returns. The efficacy of the drugs are not, you know, not going to be there. So there was this argument, and I wanted her to have therapy and nutritional counseling. She refused, and the reason she refused at those meetings, she refused because, as we now know, eating disorder is something that they have control over, they want to have control over, and as soon as you intervene, they lose their control. It's a symptom of depression, just like cutting is, just like sometimes drug use is. And she didn't want to let go of one thing she had control over. So she was very emphatic that there's no nutritional counseling. So the pshara, the compromise we came up with was, the social worker told us, you know what, why don't we start with a therapist, have her see a therapist, and then three or four times into it, you know, the therapist, by the way, a therapist, again, who specializes in eating disorders, therapist will kind of get easier into having her go see a nutritionist as part of the team, which I agreed. This, it ended up being, instead of four meetings, it ended up being 4 months. Let me back up. Our personal physician suggested a particular nutritionist to go see, but of course, because you have refused to do this, we had to delay this, even though we had discussions with the nutritionist. By way of divine providence, about 4 months into this therapy, which was going very well, actually, she did very well in the therapy. About 4 months into this therapy, the therapist emails my wife and I and says, you know what, I think Yocheved will do very well with yoga. And there's a person starting a class in yoga, and perhaps she should attend this yoga class. And when I saw the email, I was shocked because the therapist had mentioned the name of someone who was recommended to us as a nutritionist, the same person. So we thought, yay, you know, this is an opportunity for Yocheved to get to know this person who's giving this yoga class, who happens to be a nutritionist. And that's exactly what happened. She went to the yoga class, which she really enjoyed, and she started seeing this particular nutritionist. She saw the nutritionist for about, I'd say for about a month. And then the nutritionist called us up and said she needs a higher level of care. She's not maintaining her or even achieving her weight goals, and she needs to go to residential. So then started the whole search for residential. We searched high and low, and this is also where religion gets in the way. Because as soon as we heard residential, okay, we've got to find a kosher place. I believe there are about two in America. One I know for sure, maybe even two. And I was having discussions with many people, and one in particular, I can mention his name because he was very helpful along the way, Rabbi Benny Tzipel from Chabad of Utah.
Yeah, Great man.
A good man. Was a classmate of mine in Yeshiva in Morristown. Utah, for some reason, is a state which has a lot of facilities for mental health, be it drugs, be it depression, be it eating disorders. So I spoke to him, and I was getting, I was kind of bouncing ideas off him, and I told him this whole thing about kosher. And he said to me, "Avrami, don't be an idiot. You know, just find the best program for her as opposed to the kosher program.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be in the way." He says, talk to your rabbi. And I thought about it for 30 seconds, and I realized, man's right. And we ended up sending her to a program that he had recommended called Center for Change in Orem, Utah. She was there. And unfortunately, fortunately, she did very well there. Unfortunately, and sad for us, it coincided with the Jewish holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. She was there for an entire month of Tishrei. But she was there and she did well. And actually, they refed her, which is a very big deal. I think she gained, you know, many pounds, which kind of got her to her weight goals, while at the same time dealing with the psychological components, obviously medicating her and so on. She was eventually released with a bunch of conditions, you know, for us and for her. The original nutritionist and original therapist were part of the team, and they were in touch with the people in Utah. And we knew the weight goals and what's considered yellow, orange, and green. Interestingly enough, when she came back, she was able to maintain those goals. And she was very, very determined to heal. She really was. It's not like she wanted to. She realized that she has to heal, you know. I think as it turns out, she was healing physically. But unfortunately, the psychological, the depressive source of this illness, you know, did not catch up with that, and it remained with her. Then in about, I would say, November, literally a year after her first attempt, she had a second attempt using the same method, which is interesting because if, you know, the first method didn't work, why would she use the method again? But she used the same method, did not work. And I'm like, oh no, all these gains we made in Utah will be lost. Her mood this time, unlike her first hospitalization, her mood this time was great from day one. She was just in great spirits. She wanted to go home. They wanted her to, now she just come back. Remember, she just come back from, you know, residential center, residential facility. In this facility, they wanted to release her to another residential facility, this time for depression, and to address the suicidality. And we were like, you know, just, we wanted to just spend a couple of weeks at home. Hanukkah was coming up. We weren't opposed to residential. Yechaver was adamant that she did not want residential. She's more adamant than us, I think. But we kind of said, you know, let's work out the conditions. Let us spend a couple weeks at home. And we'll consider the residential component. In the meanwhile, you know, they were very emphatic that she has to be released to a program. She can't just go from hospital to home without any rules. They discussed with us many, many rules. One of the rules were she didn't have access to her medication. We guarded her 24 hours a day. My wife slept in her room. At the same time, she was accepted for a day program at Ohel, which was difficult because, you know, it took a while to get off the ground, and also because of COVID, a lot of things were not in person. I just want to say, and I should have said this at the beginning of our discussion, whatever I say, I'm not blaming anything or any one thing in particular for what eventually happened.
Yeah.
I don't think that's helpful, all the points over here.
Yeah.
She was doing very, very well. She was doing very well. She was in good spirits. Surprisingly, she maintained her weight pretty well. We found out later, and she even wrote about this. She was very brilliant. She wrote about this, that if an eating disorder patient is doing well, or even if someone who's depressed is doing well, it's not necessarily a great thing. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we were weighing her every single day And then when she was maintaining her goals or maintaining her weight, at the advice of therapy, let's not wear every single day because it shouldn't be a focus of her recovery. Let's wear it twice a week, you know, thinking with the idea that she's doing well. Unfortunately, and I think this is the message, that when they're doing well, it's not necessarily a good thing. It might be that they're kind of resigned to another goal, in this case, suicide. And then they're just kind of giving up. They said, okay, I'll eat, or I'll look the way I don't want to look, or I'll be happy against my own wills and desires, and I'll do well. And she really was doing well. She was happy. She was involved. And we didn't allow her to have any money, because with money she could buy drugs. And when I say drugs, I mean over-the-counter medicine. I don't mean illegal drugs. She wouldn't be able to buy implements that she could hurt herself with. And I just posted yesterday, someone asked on Telegram, do you consider yourself an honest person? And she answered, yes, I consider myself an honest person, but not within the definition of where my eating disorder presents itself. And that is exactly what happened. You know, as an eating disorder patient, she found ways to kind of manipulate the system and manipulate and to find ways around the fact that she didn't have any money. It's found ways around the fact that she was being guarded 24 hours a day. And so that's exactly what happened. You know, she volunteered at a local place called JLI, who was amazing to her, very helpful. And literally around the corner from our home, my wife would walk her there every single day and pick her up 2 hours a day. We thought everything, that's great. Yeah, because apart from those 2 hours, you know, she was with us 24 hours a day. At JLI, she was with people all the time who would know any better. And that's what happened. She went to JLI and she told her coworker, I'll be back. I'm just going to be going for a few minutes. Let me just back up. The day before that, she had a most amazing day. She went out with my wife and son to a mall. There's pictures, there's video, having the most glorious day. That night, she attended a l'chaim of a cousin of ours. She came back. We watched videos together. The next morning, I asked her to make me breakfast. She did. I said goodbye to her. I said, have a wonderful day. As if there's nothing going on. My wife walked her to her volunteer job at JLI. I think literally within 5 or 10 minutes of her being there, she told her coworker, I'll be back in a few minutes. And that's what happened. She was not back in a few minutes. She used the opportunity to kind of flee her captivity, and she took her life. That's really where that part of the story ends.
Yeah. I cannot imagine the pain and the grief that that you and your family are going through right now. I mean, how you're finding the strength to even talk about this, to go on, to be an outspoken advocate for mental health matters when most people would be curled up in a ball crying in the corner. You know, I've heard you talk about the firm community focusing on the core roots of the mental health issues, you know, addressing things from when the child's young, and the work that we can do preemptively within our schools and institutions, rather than focusing on those who already are in crisis. Not that it's too late ever, but I'm saying rather putting focus on that. And both of us obviously needs our attention, but can you elaborate on why you are choosing to put your emphasis on this idea? And what exactly is your philosophy that you're sharing for the world? You know, like I know that you've written a lot of things on Facebook, and maybe it's easier for you to share this message with all of us about what you have as an idea to go forward, how we can help our young ones. Preemptively.
Okay. I think you asked like 10 questions over there. So I'm going to try to remember.
I tend to do that.
I'm going to try to remember all of them. So first of all, let me say again, just to reiterate, I'm not a professional. So this is just my own observations.
Right, obviously. And I think I just want to say that that's an important piece too. Like, you know, we know that you're not an expert. We know you're not a psychologist or a therapist, but you're in the parsha, you're in the experience, and you have what to share with us.
And by the way, my daughter had a degree in psychology, helped many of her friends get into treatment for various kinds of mental health challenges. And she, if you go on telling them, you see her app, she answers, you know, many, many questions about her journey and giving advice. And she always said, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a therapist, and so on. So about addressing mental health after the fact. I mean, who am I? There are so many people talking about it today, and thank God in the, you know, the Frum community, the Orthodox community, it's less of a taboo than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Thank God.
Thank God.
We've made strides. Exactly.
Right. So we're able to discuss it, and it's important to discuss it, especially for those who seek care. But I didn't find, as I started this process of healing, kind of also accidentally, because I would not have thought in my wildest dreams that I'd be taking a positive spin on everything. I thought I'd just completely disheveled. But I started writing a lot, and I started sharing a lot, and that for me was very, very helpful. And what I found was that no one's really talking about the fact that there's a massive increase today in mental health disease. I think there's a psychiatric nurse practitioner that told me statistics since 2006 has been an increase of 60% among young women of suicide. So what is going on? Why is everybody taking medication? Every second kid is taking medication.
Yeah.
Like what is going on? What is wrong with our society that we've come to this point? You know, we've made so many strides in different areas, technology and education and openness and so on. But yet there are so many kids that are suffering. To be honest with you, I have more questions than answers. But I think I would like, you know, if those would be the questions, those would be the topics discussed, because you know, the person that's 16, 17, 24 years old, that's my daughter's case, we've got to get the professionals involved. But let's talk about the five-year-olds. You know, let's compare a five-year-old's life to when we were 5 years old, and how is it different? And we can talk about a few things. I think that when we were 5 years old, we had a lot more physical activity in our lives. We were making our friends. We went to school, we were making our friends. We were not being limited by social media and the internet, which is a whole parasha, whole subject unto itself. And we're able to develop interpersonal relationships. Again, I don't know if it's a contributor. I think there's a lot of studies out there that have been showed that the overuse of electronics, and not only internet, just being on an electronic device, as opposed to developing this, you know, interpersonal relationship, is dangerous. I want to mention someone by name, Rabbi Shagalov, who is a therapist, lives in Massachusetts. I once heard a talk that he gave about the use of electronic media. And what was so refreshing to me was that I think 5 minutes of the talk was religion-based. And most of it had to do with the psychology component. I think the Frum world, I don't know if your listeners are mostly Frum or not, Orthodox world, has missed a major opportunity with this, because they catch it within the framework of religion when it's not a religious
issue
at all.
Or about the brain.
Mostly not religious. It's about the brain. It's about, you know.
Yeah.
If you search for, I think his name is Simon Sinek, he'll talk about this dopamine rush that you get from hitting a like, you know, the like button on Facebook.
Yeah.
So it's really a psychological issue, and we have to address it as such. There is also the issue of the overuse of medication. There's a wonderful book called Lost Connections by Yohan Hari. Yohan Hari was someone who he himself was medicated for many years, and then he went on a journey of realizing that medication is not the answer, but rather connections with yourself. You could be lonely. You can be lonely in Times Square, or you can be, at peace in your bedroom. You know, I'm quoting there from someone I don't remember who, so that's why I can't give. Mm-hmm. I apologize if I'm not.
That's fine.
Giving them credit, but every second kid is being medicated. The brain is not something that you can treat like a heart. They think they have all the answers. And here's the other thing that we have to realize, and this is what we, I think we're trusting the medical mental health profession too much. And here's the reason why. It's a very young science, 50 years old in its current iteration, right? Yeah. I'm talking about post, mental side of it that would lock people up, in all kinds of ugly places. But, modern psychology, modern medicine is very, very, is very young science. They don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. Most will tell you they do have all the answers, and that's the problem. You'll go to a therapist and say, I have the answers, but in truth, they don't. What's more important is that I don't think they're asking the right questions. And that's part of the problem. And we, as parents, as lay people, we trust them. And as I'm starting conversations with other therapists, just in discussions, just informal discussions post this, I'm finding a few that are really, really humble. Those with amazing, amazing credentials and training, and admitting, we just don't have all the answers. We're going to try this. We're going to try that. Medication is obviously called for, not anti-medication at all.
I get that. No, I have to agree with you. I mean, it's almost sometimes feels as if they throw things at the patient and see if it sticks. And then they try another one, and then they try another one, because some people have certain reactions to medications, others do not. So it's really a trial and error in most medications with mental health. It's trial and error.
Exactly. It is trial and error, but it's not even the goal. In other words, to have them medicated for life is not the goal.
Right.
The goal is to have them live as healthy people. And I believe medication is a tool to help them be comfortable to address whatever it is that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
Whether it's depression or eating disorder or drug addiction and so on. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you one more question.
Sure.
The beginning of the question I asked you, what is holding you up? What is giving you this ability to sit here, even to talk to me and go on with, get dressed in the morning, go take on, continue your life. What is it?
I'm feeding off people's appreciation. And I would always tell my daughter this as well. I try to give her advice. I always would tell her, and she did, she was a giver. I said, giving is the best form of getting, And we can talk about that as well, about, kids doing, physical projects, do something for somebody or do something for yourself, clean up your room, do a puzzle, do your laundry, do something that you can, feel. And when I started writing, I started getting this amazing feedback. And it shocked me. People started reaching out to me, my friends, people that I knew from 20 years ago, and people that I don't know. And these are mostly people that I did not know. And I started feeding off this, and I said, what's going on over here? Why are they reaching out to me? I was very confused, because I'm just, one father grieving. And the message was constant. You're helping me. Thank you for talking about it. Thank you for being open and honest. Thank you for sharing your daughter's journey with us. So it kind of, one thing led to the other, and I kept on talking about it and kept on writing about it. And I think that's how I met you and your husband, actually.
Yeah.
And
so you're saying that your writing is giving back, the feedback that you're getting on this is holding you, is helping you.
It's helping me because I feel that way. I don't feel, I'll tell you straight up, by nature, I'm a catastrophizer.
Yeah.
And I do have in my own life proclivity for depression, 100%. And yet, this has not been my experience in the almost 3 months since this has happened.
Wow.
I thought I'd completely fold, but I did not fold. And, my message to others that are dealing with this, I'm saying post, not dealing with kids that are suffering, but dealing with loved ones that unfortunately have taken their lives. And it's a very final thing, right? Yeah. The finality with it, about it, to talk about it, cry about it. My daughter even wrote to us, get together as a family, keep the family together, cry about it, talk about it. I think it's very, very important. If you can't talk about it publicly like the way I do, get a therapist, get a friend, and really, don't keep it.
Let it out. Don't keep it in. Absolutely. I think that's part of our problem in our community is we're so busy trying to keep everything secret and not talk about it. No one should know that it's eating us up and eating our children up and even more.
I don't find that, by the way.
You know?
I don't find that. That people are trying to keep it a secret.
That's great.
I respect
those. I'm happy to hear that.
I respect those that are keeping it a secret. But again, we have to remember that many, many parents are keeping it secret for their kids, right?
Right, exactly. It's not theirs to share. It's not their story to share. Our children's challenges and struggles. And right.
And I didn't until my daughter became public.
Open it with it. Yeah, that's very true, especially when they're, you know, so we
shouldn't mistake that for like some taboo of speaking about it.
Exactly. Let me ask you another question. I know that you're not technically qualified medically to give your opinion, but at the same time, Ein Chacham Kibala Nisayin, right? There's no one wiser than someone who's been through the experience. So your reflections are some ways more helpful than the clinical profession opinions. So what about someone who's listening, okay, who doesn't have a child who's struggling, let's say with an eating disorder or addiction or a major trauma, but rather a young child who's angry, has low self-regulations, is yelling a lot, fighting with their siblings, crying a lot. And, you know, a lot of times we think this is normal behavior, that she's tired, this, that. But what I've seen in my own personal journey as a mom and professionally as a positive psychology practitioner and life coach, we think that it's normal, but usually it's a sign of something simmering underneath that must be addressed. Like the behaviors that we see are like the tip of the iceberg. And a lot of people say, just ignore it. The behavior will go away on its own. I find that that's not true, that we need to get our children that are struggling with self-regulation help. And I'm curious, does this idea resonate with you? What are your thoughts on that?
So there's two extremes. It's a good question. So I'm going to criticize cancel culture.
Okay.
So today everything is, you know, you say one little thing, you know, then it's offensive, right? So we have to differentiate between normal living. You know, people get angry. There's a whole range of emotions that people have. People get angry. People criticize. Parents, as I have, will scream at their children, right? Parents sometimes hit their children, you know, as a form of punishment. Children get angry. Children lash out. Question is it chronic or is it normal behavior? If it's normal behavior, then it's normal behavior. And if we try to cancel that out completely,
right,
then they're not going to be able to have the skills to regulate normal life, real life, because everything is so protected. Everything is so, you know, cheery that one day there's going to be a challenge or a predicament, and you know how we fall apart. And before I spoke with you, I was speaking to someone that I greatly respect, and we were discussing this, and she wrote to me. She said, you know, if we teach academic skills, why can't we talk? Why can't we teach emotional regulation?
Yeah,
you know, teach kids how to do that. But I will say that it starts at home, because we can't just, you know, rely on the schools to take care of our kids' emotions. That's you know, we're a father and a mother. As a therapist told me, though, you know, at the beginning of this process when I was feeling very guilty, and one will find that, you know, for those of us that have gone through this, the guilt is overwhelming.
Yeah.
And he said to me, Remy, can you build me a spaceship? And I said, no. I said, why not? And I said, because I don't know how. So he said to me, well, that's exactly the same thing with parenting. We learn as we go along. So we try to fix mistakes of those that came before us, but we will never perfectly parent. Right? So, but we try, but it's up to us. And we can always have to do better, and we always have to pay more attention. And you're right. You know, those kids that are showing anger and resentment and lashing out, it should be dealt with. It should be dealt with on two levels. The parents, the schools need to get involved in the sense that they need to get out of the way.
Right? Tell me more about that. What do you mean by that?
Because, and I'm still hearing this, right? I'm still hearing this thing, you know, especially in from schools. And so that is still a problem where they dismiss the issue. They'll dismiss certain red flags. And that's a problem. And when it's brought to their attention, they'll try to dismiss it. Now, they're trying to look good. So many times they push religion over mental health and so on. And they, you know, let's say they're strict. You know, it has to be done wisely. Let's say there's a whole bunch of, you know, rules for the school. But if a kid is, you know, struggling, they should notice that a kid is struggling and, you know, maybe be a little lenient for that particular kid. You know, just do it wisely, judiciously, and so on. And I'm finding that still the schools are not getting out of the way. I can tell you, a parent that called me, a close friend of mine, and he said to me, "Remy, I need your advice." And it's someone that I work with a lot. He said to me, "My daughter, who's 8 years old, is counting calories on a cracker." Because why? She was bullied at school and she was fat shamed. And the school is not overweight by any stretch. She's a normal looking girl. So I said to myself, and I said to my wife, I said, I don't even know how to count calories. I don't know what that means. That an 8 year old had the wherewithal to figure out how to count calories. And, you know, going back to the school, you know, he tried a few times to speak to the school and, you know, talk to the kids that are bullying and so on. And it took a while. And I said to him, "You got to put your foot down. You got to really put your foot down, call the print, you know, and I don't know, so, you know, be very clear about the fact that they got to stop this right away, because this is a huge problem." Bullying is also a problem on the internet. And I'm told by those in the profession that it's a bigger problem. Bullying on the internet is a bigger problem.
Because you're more comfortable to talk about things behind a screen than in person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more systemic. It's more painful.
So what I'm hearing you say is that parents need to be advocates for their kids, meaning don't just take things sitting down, you know, be on top of the schools, be on top of your child's care, do what you can at home, be proactive as possible to help your child. Don't wait for somebody else to help step in. You need to do everything you can to help your child.
Yeah, there's an added component. It's a messy experience.
Ugh.
Why is it a messy experience? Because every parent wants to be their child's friend.
Yes.
And that's not a good thing. You're not your child's friend. You're your child's parent, right? Your job as a parent is to bring them up and teach them values, show, you know, teach them resilience, and to have them teach them how to self-correct. So oftentimes when you're going to discipline them, I speak to parents who say, "I can't take I can't fight with my 12-year-old and have a smartphone. I can't take it away. I mean, you know,
they're going to be a screaming match." They're scared of the tantrum. They're scared of the kids' reaction.
Just take it away. I mean, you know, it's not good for them. Just take it away. So I think that's what something that parents have to realize. They should. And you know what? Let's be humble and get parenting lessons and learn these things and try to not make those errors.
Also, in addition, I think a lot of us tell ourselves, "Oh, everyone's doing it. Everyone's child has a smartphone. This is society. We can't just stop them. We can't take it away from them." And they try to normalize it. And I think that's excuses that we tell ourselves so that we could not have to do the hard work, because taking it away is the hardest thing. I know in my home, I have set limits of you know, iPad or iPod usage, and I'm fought back on it. They fight me tooth and nail. They will sell anything for some.
What age?
All ages. Screen time. There's the biggest fights that we have.
Like, ask anybody, why are you giving to them in the first place?
That is true too.
I did it.
That is very true too.
And it's
become our babysitters in many ways. It's just the easiest. I don't think our parents were raising us even had this option. There was nothing that kept kids this quiet ever. And this is the repercussion of that we're seeing. And it's so hard, but it's so important.
There's another very interesting thing I want to add about the internet.
Okay.
You're not possibly talking about your kids on the internet. You're just talking about your kids.
No, I'm not talking about internet. I'm talking about, tens. I mean, here and there, it's like, you know, watching a video. I don't think it's straight up social media, stuff like that, but it's apps, it's games, it's all the buzzing lights and things chiming in and that dopamine release in their brain.
That's right. It's not a good thing.
No.
I was interviewed by Dr. Raj Prasad, who's a psychotherapist in England, for a documentary he was doing. And he shared with me a very interesting thought about the internet. He used the word dismiss. He said that young children and even young adults are not able to expose themselves to the internet and dismiss that which is bad and retain that which is good. We only develop that later on in our mid-20s, and which is why the internet is so dangerous for children for sure, and even young adults. And this is coming from someone who has no knowledge of the Jewish Orthodox community at all. We're talking a lot about the internet, of course, but there's other stuff, you know, about, you know, regulating and being parents, not being friends. I think that's very, very important.
Very important.
Not having to be friends, you know.
Yeah. I want to ask you another question.
Sure.
This is a very personal question. And as a parent of a, you know, children, my own child who's struggling with some, you know, emotional challenges, I know that it brings a lot of pain. And I speak to parents that have children that are struggling, and it brings pain and difficulties for the rest of the family, for the other siblings too. And there can be at times like a tiny voice that wishes for it all to end. And naturally, it's not what the parents really want. And there's an incredible amount of guilt, even just verbalizing this. But just at the thought, in a small way, there's a sense that if it ended there'd be a small measure of relief that it's final and it's over. But at the same time, it's such a painful thing to even think about or even discuss. But I know that parents of struggling children sometimes do have those thoughts and feelings, and they feel guilty about that. And it hurts them that they even can think this way. Can you speak to this idea at all?
When you talk about end, you're talking about one's ending of one's life. Is that what you're talking about?
I think so. Parents think this through all the way, but when you're dealing with a child who is, you know, has suicidal ideations or has struggling with addictions or be it whatever it may be,
right,
eating disorders, I mean, they all stem from a mental health issue. There's no addict out there that's using because they just want to annoy their parents, or not eating food because they want to hurt their mother and father. It's just all coming from pain. So I'll
answer that as a father. I'll answer that as a Jew.
Okay.
As a father, not for one second. Not for one second did it ever cross my mind. All we wanted was healing. And we were positive that there's going to be healing. Not only were we positive, but my daughter was positive as well. She wanted a heal. She was unable to in the end, but she wanted a heal. So not for a second. Does it mean that others in the family pay the price? Of course. I mean, that's to be, you know, those that would deny that would be lying, because there's disproportionate amount of energies, you know, given to your children, and those that need it more, others are going to lose out. And it's, yeah, you know, we know that, and we try to make up for as much as possible, but it's often not the case. So wishing it to end, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And then we can follow this into the Jewish way. You'll find when people have physical illnesses, that in many cases when someone is terminal, the patient or the family, you know, makes a decision to cut off, you know, life support and so on. We never do that. You know, us as Jews, we never, ever, Orthodox Jews, we never, ever, ever do that. Right. We hold on to the very, very last moment.
Right.
So that's part of my DNA. I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that, you know, the first part of your question, I don't think any parents would think that way. I can tell you that I'm part of an elite group on, not elite, a private group on Facebook, parents of children who have lost their lives, mostly non-Jewish. No one has that sentiment. No one ever had that sentiment. I can tell you from talking to a lot of parents.
Wow.
No, nobody ever has that thought. Yes, everyone feels, you know, has feelings of guilt and so on, but no one ever thought while they were alive that, well, we wish this would end. Nobody has that thought.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I know that's a very loaded question. If you could talk to the schools or mechanchim and teachers and yeshivas, or of like parents, like they were just listening to you and you would have to, you know, give them a short message, what would your message to them be? What would you tell them from your experience?
I'm not sure you're asking about Chabad.
I don't think it matters. I think any
Orthodox, non-Orthodox.
Okay, let's talk about the Orthodox Chabad. What, you know, whoever's listening in their world, I think it's, let's talk about the schools, our system that we find our systems. Yes.
So number one, like I said, they have to get on this page where they have to, you know, be willing to recognize when there's a problem. But we have another problem in that 20 years ago, no one talked about it. No one talked about professional help. Today, we talk about it a lot. And we bring in psychologists, and we bring in therapists, and all kinds of things. We're open about it, much more than we were 20 years ago. And what's being put by the side is the Torah view. So my message would be that both are necessary, right? So, for example, Tanya, which talks a lot about you know, sadness and human feeling and emotion and so on. If a kid is chronically ill, do you open up a Tanya and heal them? Of course not. Tanya was written for healthy people. Just like you don't open Tanya if you had the cardiac event. But at the same time, they have to coexist. Us as religious Jews, we have to understand that it's Torah that gave the ability to the mental health profession to give us advice. You know, the doctors, it's through God's hand and so on. But we always have to include what Torah, and in our case, we're lucky as Chabad Hasidim, a Hasidic thought which, you know, plays a large role in human emotion. It has to be combined. It hasn't been combined yet. Organizations have reached out to me in the Frum community, you know, wanting me to be on board with them and so on. And I asked them, you know, here you're a psychologist and therapist, where you're a Rabbani, where you're Mashpim, and they didn't have. I said, well, when you get those, you know, let me know. So I think both are necessary.
Yeah.
That's one message.
Well, so just in keeping time short, I have so many more questions I want to ask you.
Okay.
I know this is so very loaded, and I just want you to know that I'm grieving with you, and I thank you for your public work that you're doing to share and help others. Just want to ask, you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to share with everyone on mental health or on eating disorder specifically, on surviving or surviving and grieving at the same time, if that's possible, or anything that you'd like to just leave us with?
I don't have any. I mean, that's, again, you asked me 10 questions. I'll just say that positivity is something that we abide by as Chabad Chassidim, and if everybody out there, if anybody wants to contact me, they're welcome to. And keep on getting educated. Get yourself, you know, get your hands on any book, podcast, education about mental health. It's more prevalent now and more important now than it ever was. And just remain open and honest and empathetic and humble. And know that, you know, ask the questions and know that you're not going to get all the answers. But ask the questions. Always, you know, dig.
Keep digging.
Never rest, especially as a parent.
It's like the Avos. We're always digging wells. I spoke about that. We spoke about that in the, like, that idea of just constantly searching, keep on digging within ourselves, within what's in the Torah, what's available with Chassidus, and within psychology and mental health, what's out there for us. Like you said, that's a very great point that you said, that, you know, Tanya is good for somebody who's healthy to learn how to live a full life and meaningful life, but it's not necessarily, we have to look a little deeper for somebody who's sick, who is not well, and we need to look at it as that they're not choosing this. This is something that Hashem has given them, and we need to help them battle this.
Yeah, I think the Rebbe though did talk about when choosing a therapist, try to use a Frum therapist.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
There's a lot to be written about that. I don't know the source, but I can get back to you on that.
Yeah, I think I'm sure there's plenty of that, and I've also seen how for some people it depends on the person. I think if somebody themselves is not necessarily on that path and is in a different path, they need to find the right therapist that fits
100%. Their. So I apologize for making that statement in a way, because obviously has to be qualified. Because
I don't remember. Yeah, I think it's, and also another piece that I find very important is that some people will say, "I found a therapist, but it didn't work. I tried. This is, it's not like a one size fit all, and it's not like an immediate, you know, it takes years. It's progress. It's slow. We need to find the right person. And if you don't find the right person, don't give up. Try again. Keep trying. Let's just never give up on our children, on ourselves, on our spouses, our family. And may Hashem bless us with continued health and nachas from all of our children and our families. Again, thank you so much for your time.
Very welcome.
Truly appreciate that.
You're very welcome. All the best. Take care.